Okay, so I think we can continue. So I was now going to say a bit about the underlying formal semantics for these failure scenarios. Yeah, so this is sort of sketched on this slide. Or firstly, actually, here I'm not yet defining the formal part or the semantics part of it, but still here on the syntax level. So what I define now as an extension for the UML, I define different kinds of stereotypes. So firstly, for the different failure semantics models which I mentioned, I define each a stereotype. Of course, as I said, there are more failure semantics models, and so there are also then more stereotypes, but here I would just mention two of them. So crash performance and value, and the goal is that you can attach them to a diagram, more specifically a communication link, to specify that the physical characteristic of this communication link corresponds to this failure semantics. So this is the syntax level, and then to attach some kind of meaning to it for each such stereotype and for each redundancy model, we had a set of expressions of the form delay t, loss t, and corrupt q, where in each case t is a number representing the expected maximum time delay. Then p is a probability number representing the probability that a value is not delivered within t, and q represents the probability that the value which is delivered in time is in fact corrupted. These are all these arguments of those failures. So this corresponds to the three different kinds of failures which I mentioned on an earlier slide, and this is sort of how we model this or how we include this in the UML extension. Firstly, on the syntactic level using the stereotypes, and secondly towards the semantic level, firstly just by including these possible failures, and I will say a bit more about the semantics on a later slide.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
What is the formal relation between the two view expressions?
Which ones?
The stereotype in the second line and in the third line?
Yes. Okay, yes. So the stereotype is just a symbol on the whole.
Yes.
And then for each such stereotype and for each redundancy model R, where R is also a symbol at this point, you define a set, which is a subset consisting of sets in these kind of values.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the relationship. I would say a bit more about that, how this works then.
This is the way you write it in UML?
This is UML, the stereotype, it's just the double angle brackets, and this is just plain mathematical notation, just specifying sets. Mm-hmm. Oh, another question.
Yeah, what are the differences between delay and loss?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I mean, these two different kinds of failures are sort of on different end of the same scale. So delay means that delay t means that, if you take the two together, if you have delay t and loss p, this means that with probability 1 minus p, the value is actually delivered within the time bound T. So these this probability is taken relatively to the time period T. So if you specify probability, then you also need to specify this delay. Or if you leave it out, then this means generally that the value is lost. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, and in each case, already incorporating the redundancy model. And so for an example, so if we assume that we have a redundancy model R, just the name again, which means that we use a certain controller with redundancy 3, so we have 3 copies of the controller, and as a voting process we just take the fastest result, then now the question is which kind of values I would use here as the arguments. So here T would be the delay of the fastest controller, because I can just give back the result whenever the fastest controller is done. T is the probability that this fastest result is in fact not delivered within T, and Q is the probability that this fastest result which is delivered is then corrupted. And then still on the syntax level, we have a second kind of stereotype, and this sort of matches the earlier stereotype. So the earlier stereotype we could use on the level of the physical layer of the system model to say what properties the physical model has. And then this we use on the level of the logical model of the property to specify which requirements the system should satisfy. So the earlier one are the physical sort of the physical situation, and this is now what we would like to have. And then of course the next question would be whether these two views are consistent, whether what our physical level gives us actually fulfills these guarantees. And there's then again another stereotype for formalizing this constraint. But firstly, the guarantee is then again formulated parallel to the three kinds of failures which I mentioned already. So with respect to time, one can then specify that there should be a certain degree of immediacy when delivering a value, namely the value should be delivered within T, except for, you can also specify that this only has to happen with a certain probability P, again similar to what we've seen before, and again similar, you can give a probability Q that the system is required to deliver the value which is not corrupted. And then, as I said, one would like to check whether the two views match, whether our requirements or the guarantees that we postulate are actually fulfilled by the physical level of the system. And for that, one can use another stereotype, save links. And now here we have the situation that you actually have a constraint associated with this stereotype, namely the constraint, so informally speaking, that for each dependency with this, which is stereotyped guarantee, and for each communication link over which this communication dependency is located, and which carries the stereotype S, we have to check for each of the three aspects, namely the delay, the loss, and the corruption. We have to check whether the guarantee that we would like to have is actually matched by the physical level. And these two line, or the three conditions here, simply formalize this condition that the guarantee should be met. So, for example, the the delay which arises from the physical level, including the redundancy model, should be bounded by the delay which is admitted by this guarantee stereotype. And similar for the other two kinds of failures. So in this example, it's just a very simple example just to explain the idea. We have two nodes connected by a communication link, which is a stereotype with this failure semantic crash performance, which we've seen. And on each of the nodes, we have a component. And the two components are then also linked by a communication dependency, which has a certain guarantee associated with it. Namely, the goal is that the value should be should require this immediate T goal, so it should be delivered within T. And then, now if we suppose that we have no redundancy included in the system, the question is under which condition this previous stereotype safe link, which we defined here, is actually fulfilled in this diagram. So I don't know if anyone can guess whether this is the case here. So I will just try to talk through that. So to firstly, we have to sort of remember what the safe links meant. So, and again, informally, this means that for each of the different kinds of failures, the goal is actually supported by what we get on the physical level. So if we look at this this example, so the goal, the only goal we have here is the this immediate T goal, and so we have to check whether the corresponding failure in on the failure semantic level is supports this, and this is then the delay failure. And yeah, looking at the example, we see that okay, we have a crash performance failure semantics here, which means which means that we have three different kinds of failures, and we have to consider the argument of this delay failure, which is associated with the crash performance stereotype. And so, the answer is then that the constraint associated with safe links is fulfilled if and only if this argument of the immediate goal is larger than the expected delay according to this failures set for the non-redundancy model and for the crash performance failure semantics. So it's just a sort of a simple match between the two views on these kinds of requirements. And then next kind of stereotype, which has a similar constraint associated with it, and this this makes sure that there's a consistency between the different requirements which one can formulate on the data in a given class diagram. And so this this goes back on the observation we had earlier that in static critical systems one often considers safety levels, and these one can then actually include in the UML class diagram using firstly this critical stereotype and using again associated tags. So I use this critical stereotype to attach it to a class model which is somehow assumed to be critical, and then I have different staging levels, which I then use as tags. And for each of the tags, I have then an associated set of goals, which should be associated with the safety level. And so this I can define for a specific situation in my given application domain. And the constraint then is that whenever I have a class C and a class D with a dependency D from C to D, which has this guarantee stereotype which we saw on the earlier slide, then the constraint is firstly that the goals on the data in D should be the same as the goals on the data in C, and secondly, the goals of the data in C, which also appears in D, should be met by the guarantees which are attached with the communication dependency D. So again, for an example, so here we now have this this class diagram, in which one of the two classes is considered to be critical by including this stereotype, and this then has this tag with this tag real time, which corresponds to a safety level real time, and this now says that the measure operation which is offered by this other class, that this should be of the safety or on the safety level real time. And then we also assume that that the safety level real time has as one of its goals this immediate off-key goal, meaning or saying that the value, the return value of measure should be returned within time bound t. So this is the goal formulated here, and then. Then we can again wonder whether in this class diagram included in the subsystem, which then carries this safe dependency stereotype, if we can wonder whether this constraint associated with the stereotype actually is fulfilled by the class diagram which is included here. So, and then we can also think a bit about that. And yeah, again we go back to the definition which we just did. So firstly to see whether safe dependency is provided under this assumption. Firstly, we have to see, of course, what again what safe dependency means exactly. And so it means that whenever we have a dependency D from C to D. So let's see. So okay, we have actually a dependency which is a stereotyped call from the controller to the sensor. So what should be? Oh yeah, okay, and it is in fact. For this dependency, we then have to see whether this the requirements in the object controller are actually met by the guarantees that are formulated in the object sensor. And so the requirement which we have here is this real-time requirement. And so we have to check whether the real-time requirement is actually then provided by the sensor object. And the point is now, as we can see, that the sensor object doesn't even have this critical stereotype, and in particular this method measure, which was supposed to satisfy to have this real-time safety level in the controller object, does not actually have the same safety requirement at the sensor object. And so this is why in this case, again, the here the self-dependency stereotype is not fulfilled in this diagram, because as we assumed here, and the immediate is one of the goals of the real-time safety level, and this was associated with the measure method at the controller, but at the center there's the measure method does not have a goal associated with it, which is what was formulated in this constraint. Yeah, now also the next couple of stereotypes will refer more to the semantical level, whereas the ones I explained so far are really mostly on the syntax level. And of course then we firstly have to think about a precise enough model of the of a fragment of UML to analyze that mathematically, and so here now we have to actually define a formal semantics for this simplified fragment of UML which we are using here. And here, well, I'm not going to actually give too much detail about this formal semantics, because that's not particularly beautiful or anything. It's just well, it consists of a lot of formulas, so we used abstract state machines for that. But well, as UML goes, the formal semantics is not so simple. Although we actually only use a simplified fragment of UML, and so I'm not going to present it here, but just say some overall information about it, namely that so the way that this semantics is then executed is, what happens there is that the abstract state machine, which models a, for example, a UML subsystem, receives at any iteration of the execution of the state machine, it receives input events, then the events are distributed within the subsystem to the different links in the deployment diagram, and to the links which lead to the recipients of the or the intended recipients of the messages, and then in the third step, the output from these links is distributed to the these values are distributed to the intended recipients, and there are the incoming values are being processed according to the specification in the UML model. And then the third step is that all of the subcomponents in the UML subsystem may produce their own outputs, and these are then again distributed to the link to the links or to the output queues. So a queue here is a UML term, which means which more or less a buffer, so input or output buffer. Although it actually the name is queue, it doesn't necessarily mean that the messages are ordered in the queue, which is a bit confusing, but that's just a UML terminology. And then, yeah, so the, one of the confusing things maybe in this setting.
Is this buffer bounded?
Well, depending on how you would like to look at it, so on the theoretical level, it's unbounded, because there you can just afford to say it's, you know, because you don't have to worry about capacity or anything. But of course, if you then want to simulate this using tool support and to analyze this, then you have to impose some bound there, because even for practical purposes. And otherwise, it would just get too complicated, probably. So it's easiest just to impose a bound there. And of course, then you have to make sure that the bound is large enough for the system under consideration. And then in the fourth step, there's a failure model applied to the the different cues between the components and the components and its environment. And this firstly was defined on the syntactic level a couple of slides ago, and I will also define it in a bit more detail at a later slide. So previously I just defined it on the syntax level. Here we go actually. So this is it. So this is the semantics part now behind this failure model, which I defined earlier on the syntax level. So here it gets a bit technical now. Firstly, as I said already, the general UML semantics which we use here includes communication links between the different components in the UML specification. And now we would like to be able to express the different kinds of failures which may arise in the setting which we mentioned earlier. And the first of them is the delay of a message. So now we have to keep track of the fact that a message is delayed also in our execution model. And this we do by instead of just using one link queue for each link in the diagram, we use a sequence of link queues, LQLN, for each time number n. And the interpretation is then, so firstly the assumption is that we have now a discrete time, so we can just talk about different time units. And the interpretation then is that the set or the multi-set LQLN contains the messages which are traveling over the link L and which will be delayed a further n time units. So they will be delivered n time units from now. And of course, correspondingly to that, at the end of each iteration of this model, one has to sort of move all the messages in these link queues up one step towards their delivery. So LQLN is then gets the value of the multiset LQN n plus 1. And whenever we get to LQL0, these messages are then distributed to the intended recipient, unless they have been lost before. And for the loss, we would like to be able to specify to happen with a certain probability. So now we also have to keep track of probabilities. And so we have here a sequence of probabilities for each possible history age. So history is a sequence of states of the system representing the possible execution of the UML specification. And for each such history, we get a sequence of probability values phn. The intention is that the phn is the probability of failure at the nth iteration in the history age. And this we can then use to model the occurrence of failure, for example, such as the loss of a message, namely whenever we have a link L with geotype S, such that loss P is in the associated failure set, then the history. There are two options. One of the options is that there are two possible extensions of a given history. Namely, firstly, the next step, the next thing that may happen, can be that the message is actually lost, because this is a possible failure scenario. And of course, the other possibility is that nevertheless the value is not lost, because the loss only happens with a certain probability. And corresponding to that, this we can now formalized in the setting. So the first case, assuming that the value will be lost now at this point, then this means that the set of values that are supposed to be delivered at this point is set to the empty set, so all messages are deleted from that set, and we have to keep track of the fact that this was supposed to be to happen with probability p, and so the value p is appended to this sequence of probability numbers phn. And the alternative is, of course, that the value is not lost, and then this set is not changed, and instead we append 1 minus p to the sequence of probability values. And similarly, we do this for the possibility of corruption of the value, and there, with probability q, what we do is that we set the message, the set LQ L0 to just contain a single specific value, which is here just written as a box, and then we get Q as another probability value. And the explanation here is that, well, of course, the box represents the corrupted value, and the assumption is here that the system uses error detecting codes in order to actually realize that the value has been lost in transit. So this is an assumption which one would do here. We can also do without this assumption, but then instead of a single value here, one would have to use a function which non-deterministically maps the intended message to just any kind of possible message, which is a bit more complicated. So for this presentation, I just used this version here. And of course, again, the other possibility is that the corruption does not take place at this point, and then we append 1 minus q to this sequence of probability values. And well, with respect to the delay, then also we have to consider then the probability. So delay t means that the value is delivered up to the probability specified in the loss. It's delivered within t. Then, of course, still we have the question: at what point within t is the value delivered? And here we also just assume for simplicity that we have a uniform distribution over the possible delivery dates within this time period t. So this is modeled by dividing for each of the possible values between 0 and t, we get 1 minus t added to this sequence of probability values, because within the time period t, the probability is 1 over t that at a given point in time, or in one of the time units, the value is delivered. Okay, this, as I said, this is getting a bit more technical here, but it's just meant to shortly illustrate that there's actually a formal model below this these notational things which I showed on the previous slides. And this, of course, one needs if one wants to construct tool support which analyzes the requirements which are included as these stereotypes which I defined on the earlier slides. And then we can proceed to other kinds of requirements formulated as stereotypes, in which now actually refer to the behavioral semantics of the UML diagram. So this is the safe behavior stereotype, for example, requiring that the system behavior fulfills a particular safety requirements, and this the safety requirement is formulated in well, these lines informally. The requirement is that for any trace H, whenever we have a value which is transmitted along a communication dependency with the guarantee stereotype, then the following constraints would hold with respect to these goals associated with the guarantee stereotype. So the constraints are then that with these sort of formulas, the intuitive constraints which I defined earlier when I talked about these three different kinds of failures. So the constraint is that firstly, with probability given as the argument of this eventual goal, we actually have the value delivered after at most so many time steps that are specified as the argument of this immediate goal. And then thirdly, also the, of course, the probability that the general value is corrupted during the transmission is at most 1 minus q. Because it was required to be correct with probability q. And okay, of course, this is now formulated informally, but hopefully from what I said on the last slide, it should be apparent that it's possible now by referring to these sequences of probabilities related or associated with a given history, one can make this constraint actually mathematically precise.
What do you mean by for any execution trace?
And this is such a history, so okay. A sequence of states and an exchanged input and output values.
Yes, okay, but how do you, it's naive that, how do you get all execution traces?
You have to define a formal execution semantics, at least for a simplified fragment of UML, and we did this, as I said, in the form of abstract state machines, and you can view them as some sort of pseudocode where you write something which you can execute and which then gives you this the possible sequences of states and input-output values. And it's in general it's this set of such sequences because there may be non-determinism inherent in the UML specification. So yeah, these sequences are given to you by this UML semantics.
So they use the state machine to produce all traces, which may be implied?
Because the state charts are finite state machines in a way. It depends on how it's how flexible or how much expressive activity you you actually use, but in the most general case, it can actually be an infinite set of histories. Yeah. So, but of course, you have to somehow cut that down if you want to deal with tool support. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Then the second kind of stereotype, which also refers to the behavioral level of the UML specification. This is the containment stereotype, and this is supposed to enforce that there is no indirect corruption of safety critical data by data which is not safety critical. And this you can then also make precise, and here I again only give the informal definition of the associated constraint, which means that to prevent indirect corruption, we can require that the value of any data element on a certain safety level should only be influenced by data which is at least at the same safety level or higher. And again, you can make this mathematically precise by referring to this execution model with the failure model included, which I defined earlier. An example for this, this is a very small and artificial example, just to explain the idea. Here we have a fuel controller, so the idea is that it controls the fuel of a, or it measures the fuel of an airplane, and for some reason the designers decided that the amount of fuel consumed so far should be computed from the time that the plane has been in air since it started. And of course, for that, you have to consider the air resistance with which the plane is, or under which the plane is traveling, to compute the used fuel. And the point is now that depending on whether the wheels were actually pulled into the plane or whether they were left outside, this air resistance is different, and that's why this model includes this. Maybe firstly, so when the plane starts, the wheels are still out, and there's the fuel. If we request to be delivered the fuel value, we get back a return value which consists of the product of the constant d, depending on the air resistance, and the amount of time passed already, which is the argument x, which was given to the component. And whenever the wheels are pulled inside, we get a different constant c here. I don't think this is actually very realistic, because it's not a very good way of measuring fuel consumption. But this could be some sort of backup system. Of course, there would be some other measure which would be taken, but of course, simply measuring the level of fuel left in the tank. But the problem with that is that this can, of course, be faulty for some reason. So this might be a backup mechanism. And so, of course, this will also be correct. And in particular, what we have included in this specification is that the requirement that while the amount of fuel consumed so far is, of course, safety critical, because we might run out of fuel. But we decide that the the amount of fuel is supposed to be safety critical, and now we have to, or we can wonder whether this containment stereotype is again fulfilled in this diagram. And this is now a bit more difficult to see than the ones in the previous examples, because this one now actually refers to the execution semantics of the diagram. So if we go back to the definition, informally the requirement was that indirect corruption of safety critical by non-safety critical data should be prevented. So we have to look at the different data values which are actually safety critical here. And the fuel attribute, or rather the fuel value of this this fuel method, and we have to see whether this the return value of this method depends in, or is somehow influenced by a non-safety critical value. The only other one we have here is this wheels in method, and this is actually not supposed to be safety critical. So one would have to find out whether the result of the fuel method is actually dependent on the input at the VSN method. And well, of course, as I already explained informally, this is actually the case because we assume that the constant C and D are different. In this example, it's possible just to establish this by informal reasoning, but maybe that this is now actually violated because the safe fuel value depends on the unsafe built-in value. But the point is that in realistic specification sizes, this is not usually not possible to see without full support. And I have to speed up a bit here now to still say a bit about security. So just to mention that of course these are not all of the checks that are relevant in this area, and that you can also include many other checks which are already given in the literature of safety checklists. So you could look at this, what I just presented here, as some way of including safety checklists in the UML notation, but also offering automated support for verifying whether the safety checks are actually fulfilled in the given specification. So it does not only make sure that for some reason you don't forget a certain safety check, but it also automatically establishes whether the outcome, the result of the check is actually positive. Yeah, so this is the part of the safety critical extension of UML. Are there any questions at this point? Then I would go on to the security critical part. The security critical part is really rather similar or in parallel to what I said about the safety, but of course adjusted to the specific requirements in the security field. So just firstly a bit of background here again. Presumably it's by now clear that security is quite an important issue, and the point is that it does not just refer to the problems such as websites being hacked or credit card numbers being lost, I bring this example later, that a couple of years ago a group of hackers from the National Security Agency in the US actually demonstrated that it would have been possible for them to break into computers of the Department of Defense and of the electric power grid system in the US, and they would have been able to bring down the power system and to bring down emergency telephone networks in Washington DC. So this is of course the specific problems which they pointed out there have been fixed, but unfortunately it's safe to assume that there are still enough bugs included in the computer systems, and it's probably just a matter of time until people who want to sabotage the infrastructures in some way at some point will also use sophisticated tools such as computers and computer networks to try to do that. Namely, at the point when the easier things such as planting bombs somewhere are not so easy anymore because of general protection. What is security about? There are three main security requirements, namely that information should be kept secret, information should not be modified by unauthorized parties, and there should be sufficient access to information. And these the requirements are called secrecy, integrity, and availability. And then there are just to point out that there are more different kinds of security requirements in specific settings. For example, in the setting of contracts, we also have the requirements of authenticity and non-refutability, and both of these are sort of complement each other and refer to the fact that firstly, it should not be possible that someone else signs a contract with my name. So this is the notion of authenticity. And secondly, whenever I sign a contract with my name myself, then it shouldn't later not be possible that I deny having done that. And so yeah, these are two further security requirements in the setting of e-commerce systems. Yeah, okay, and this is actually the example which I just mentioned. So the point is that there are many examples, and they are not just about losing your credit card number. And again, here you may wonder why systems in practice are so vulnerable. And well, apart from the reasons which I gave earlier in the safety case, it's also the case that in security, the requirements are especially difficult, because you always have to take into account an adversary which may act maliciously and intentionally, whereas in safety you would only assume that components may fail, but this is not intentional. And another example why things go wrong in practice a lot, and why I found quite a cute picture for this. So it's not enough just to use some kind of security mechanism and to put it in your system somehow, but you also have to make sure that the system is overall watertight. Well, as you can see in the system, I guess this is something which people did not think about here. So so it's an amazing picture. so that's of course also a problem in computer security. Yeah, and specifically also the problem is that the exploited information can spread quickly over the internet. So there are websites which publish information how to hack certain sites, and unfortunately the developers usually don't get feedback about how secure their products actually were in practice, because their customers are too sensitive about the issue and would rather pay up for the damage themselves than to have bad public relations. And again, here we have the setting that, okay, so far as we know, popular operating systems, whenever there are flaws detected, then we get patches distributed every once in a while, and similar for virus updates. This is not a very satisfactory approach. Firstly, it's insecure because you never know what happens until some honest guy discovers a flaw. And secondly, of course, it's very annoying. I think we probably all agree on that. So it's not good. And of course, also in this area, people have tried to solve the problem and try to use common methods to do that. And again, here we have the same problem of that the things are expensive. And maybe in security especially, because in safety, people would say, okay, before human lives are lost, I will put in some money. But in security, it's usually it's mainly just about money, and there people might say, okay, I just buy an insurance contract, and this way, I'm also this also solves the problem. which is, I guess, seems to work in practice, but it's not so satisfactory from the software engineering point of view. And again, this is the point about that you have to look at the whole picture and security. And now about the UML tag extension, so just a picture to show how such an extension looks like roughly. So it's, you can see it as a table where you have different stereotypes. So this also applies actually to the safety extension. And you have different, well, the base class, then these are the diagrams which you can attach your stereotype to, and you can also have tags associated with the stereotypes, or maybe constraints also associated. So, and I will now shortly explain some of these stereotypes in more detail. The overall approach is actually quite parallel to what we've seen in the safety case. There we formulated the different failure semantics by using stereotypes, and here you want to model adversary types, and these you can also implicitly include into the UML model, and in this case by using stereotypes types of the form internet, encryption, and so on. So this corresponds to what the value semantics stereotypes which we had in the safety case. Now instead of a failure set, we have a threat set corresponding to the fact that the actions may be intentionally committed by an adversary, and they are a bit different because, firstly, in security one usually does not worry so much about quantitative aspects such as time, probability, and so on, but only about qualitative aspects because security is complicated enough. Then we have to again consider what an adversary can do to a communication link, and again, this is similar. The adversary may delete a message, may read a message, and this is new here because adversaries are assumed to have a memory, whereas failures usually are not assumed to have that. So we now also need a read thread, that the adversary reads a message which goes over a communication link. And then insert is in a way similar to the corruption failure, only that again this relates to the fact that the adversary may have a memory and so may be able to insert, to not only modify and insert a current value, but also insert a value which was communicated earlier. And this access thread now refers to not a communication link, but instead to a component, and this means that the adversary can actually access the contents or the data contained in the component. And again here, these threads then give a semantic meaning to the stereotypes, internet, encrypted, and so on. And now again some examples to explain the different kinds of stereotypes which one can use here. So firstly, just very shortly, a use case diagram to show that this can actually be used within this this approach, although it's really rather on. Not so central here, but one would just use it to firstly state a certain requirement as a stereotype included in a use case diagram. Although at this point, it's really there's no deeper meaning behind the stereotype here, because there's not really, there's not much which you can analyze here, because it just says, okay, why is good, there are just two activities given here, and we're not told yet how these activities should actually be defined. But you can already include your requirement at this point, just to keep track of it. And so then the next step would then actually be to define these activities in more detail using, for example, activity diagrams. And there you can then actually analyze this stereotype of the exchange again precisely and on the level of the tool support. Firstly, just an explanation. Fair exchange, the idea here is that whenever I have a transaction, an e-commerce transaction where a customer buys something from a merchant, then of course we have to make sure that the transaction is fair in the sense that whenever the customer buys a good, then either he is delivered this good or he can reclaim the money. So this would be fair. And this you can again formalize by using two tags, which you can use to specify two kinds of states, namely the buy state and the sell state. And the constraint now is formalized by saying that after a buy state is reached, eventually a sell state has to be reached. And so the intended usage is as given in this diagram, that whenever, in this example, so the customer wants to buy some good and pays for it, and then either the good is delivered or the customer can ask back his money. In that sense, this diagram actually fulfills the constraint. This is not quite correct. Yes, in fact, I fixed this on some version, but I just noticed that that here is just still an old version. That's true. I should remember to exchange this here. The remark refers to the fact. What this really says and what it's not really supposed to say is that here we have two concurrent threads of activity, meaning that the point here would be, as it is specified, that both of the threads actually have to finish until the end point is reached. But this is of course not what I actually said and not what was intended. Namely, the intention was that only one of them should be reached. And that you can do with another kind of pseudo state, so-called diamond state. And if you're interested, I have the correct diagram version somewhere on the laptop, but I forget to exchange the diagram here. Okay, and then with the next kind of stereotype, this is actually quite similar to what we had in the safety case. Namely that there we had the safe links, and here again the secure links, which also makes sure that the requirements which are formulated on the logical level are actually supported by the properties given on the physical level. Specifically, the constraint is that for each dependency D with a stereotype either secrecy or integrity between two different components, the question is whether there is a communication link over which this dependency is sort of on which this dependency is based, and we have to check in the case of secrecy that there is no read threat with respect to the stereotype and a given adversary model, which is, I guess, sort of intuitive, because keeping something secret means not allowing the adversary to read this data. And conversely, for integrity, which again means that the adversary is not supposed to be able to modify data, there the formalization is that this insert threat should not be possible at the given link with, or with the link with a given stereotype and a given adversary model. And yeah, again, an example here, which is, well, again, actually quite parallel to the one we had earlier. So only now we have different kinds of requirements and physical properties. So now we have a secrecy requirement and an internet link, and we have to, if we look at the secure links constraint, we have to check whether the secrecy requirement is supported by this communication link. And so if we go back, then we see that, okay, secrecy means there should be no read threat on that link. And if we go back to the definition of internet, unfortunately there is actually this this threat, even with respect to the default adversary, meaning that pretty much everyone is able to read packets that are exchanged over internet links. So that's not really so difficult. And so, so the answer is actually that given a default adversary type, the constraint associated with this stereotype secure links is actually violated, because the internet link does not provide secrecy against the default adversary. And also, while the secure dependency stereotype here is also similar to the safe dependency one, only again that we have to refer to the secrecy and integrity guarantees. And there's also a similar example here. Only I have to hurry up a bit here because we only have half an hour left. Well, actually, the next example is also in a way similar, and I think it's actually interesting to see that there are quite a lot of requirements which are really very parallel between the safety and the security setting, although in the past, actually, at least in the researcher communities, the two kinds of application domains were really rather separate. The point, so this is similar to the containment stereotype we looked at in the safety case. So, but you also have this, or actually you originally had this in the security setting, and there are firstly, or here you actually have two kinds of stereotype: no downflow and no upflow. Where no downflow means intuitively that there should be no indirect flow of information from confidential data to non-confidential data. And the no upflow means conversely that there should be no indirect flow information from data which does not fulfill integrity to data which is supposed to fulfill integrity. So these are two of the security requirements which I mentioned earlier, and these are sort of converse. So secrecy is about not letting information out, and integrity about not letting information in. And the later or the latter requirement is actually quite similar to the containment requirement in safety, whereas the secrecy relevant one is actually the other way around. But otherwise, also this example is really rather parallel. Then there's another stereotype which is now more specific to security. So, actually, there was also this kind of stereotype in the safety case, namely safe behavior. And this one is similar in the sense that, again, one would like to now make sure that there are not only interesting stereotypes in the diagram, but also that the behavior which is specified, for example, in state charts or sequence diagrams or activity diagrams, that this behavior actually fulfills the constraints that are associated with the stereotyped types given in the diagram. And so more specifically, this data security stereotype then says that that the data which is marked as critical in some sense, and again here we can use tags to say more specifically what critical means, namely secrecy or integrity, these security requirements are actually fulfilled by the behavioral specification with respect to the threat scenario arising from the deployment diagram. And here, another example, and here it's actually a bit unfair probably to ask whether this constraint is now fulfilled in the diagram for at least two reasons. The first reason is that one is not even able to read this because it's too small, the writing. And the other reason is that, or the point really why this is now especially interesting is that even for experts, it's not, or it's entirely non-trivial to see actually whether this specification fulfills the data security requirement. Or more specifically, so the point is here, this is a security protocol where a secret could be exchanged between two partners over the internet by firstly using an asymmetric encryption key, which was distributed earlier, and by secondly exchanging a session key using this asymmetric key, and thirdly using the session key then to encrypt the secret to transmit it. So this is quite a typical scenario in security critical systems, and it's also quite typical that it's very hard very hard to design such a security protocol correctly, and even experts have made quite a lot of mistakes in this area. And also in this setting, so this is a protocol which was proposed at a conference in 1999, we actually found out that the protocol does not fulfill the security requirements which were stated in the paper. Because in fact the secret which was supposed to be transmitted secretly was not kept secret from the adversary, from the default adversary, who is of course able to eavesdrop and to insert messages on the internet link. Okay, and then there's another example which refers specifically to the Java security case, but I cannot really explain it now, but this is just to point out that you can also use this for very application-specific situations. And yeah, now again, one can wonder what in general this UML SEC extension gives you, and here I just shortly summarize the different aspects and how the extension of the UML extension includes these different aspects of security analysis and security modeling. And and in terms of security analysis. So this is again in parallel to what we've seen in the safety case. There we firstly had a domain semantics with an included failure model, and here we now have a domain semantics where we have an attacker model again included in the formal model. And to evaluate the security of a UML specification for the included security requirements, one can then execute it or simulate it or model check it together with the adversary model. And well, I don't actually have too much time to say to explain this in detail, but this is just a few slides about what you have to do in order to make this feasible at all. And this is while going back on the standard approach in formal methods on verifying security critical systems. So firstly, for example, you have to take a rather high degree of abstraction on your on the cryptographic algorithms used in your system, because otherwise it would not be feasible to verify the system on the level of bit sequences. And this is just how this looks like mathematically. So the model for the cryptographic operation, so it's just a term algebra generated by the symbolic operations. Okay, and then also, again, as I said, you have some kind of abstract adversary model, which is executed or analyzed together with the formal semantics for the UML specification. And then, well, you can also, for example, formalize what it means that an expression should be kept secret from an adversary. But I cannot really explain this here now. To skip that. Okay, now just very, okay, any questions about the security part?
So use case is part of what you
mean? Yeah, use case diagrams. Yeah. So this was just simply these ellipses with the activities contained, and then this funny man who are connected to the use cases. So it doesn't contain a lot of information, this kind of diagram, but it's useful in the early phases of system development.
I would like to find some more material over the both extensions.
Over the which one?
Over both extensions.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I mean, there's for example a book draft on the security part, and well, I give at one of the last slides I give the URL for that, and there's actually. You can also find the book draft. And incidentally, I'm also always interested in comments on the book draft because I'm still preparing it for the publication. yes, okay. Mm-hmm. Now just very quickly a bit about tool support. First about test generation. I have to run through this a bit. So test generation, as I said earlier, okay, in the end what we want is not models, but we want to have executing code, so we have to get there somehow. To some degree we can do that by code generation, but at this point it doesn't always work. So one would still have to write the programs manually, and then of course have to make sure that the program actually does what the model says. Firstly, and secondly, and so this is conformance testing, and secondly, that the program then does not include any weaknesses that were simply not contained on the model level. Because the point is, of course, that usually the model is more abstract than the code, because otherwise we could just execute the model. But this also means that if it's more abstract, that there is some information missing, and this information may actually give rise to some kind of weakness. And so, the point is that many weaknesses you can actually find on the level of the the system model, and for example the examples which I mentioned already, but there may still be others which you cannot find there. And that's also why it's useful to have, in this context, also have a way for producing test sequences from the models, not only to test that the code conforms to the model, but also that the code then does not include any additional weaknesses. And well, this I can only just mention very quickly now because of the time. Yeah, so conformance testing is of course an old topic, and even in the model-based variant where you construct test sequences from models. So I think this has been done for at least 10 years or so. For example, for formal models. So this is one thing you can do also in this UML-based approach. But the problem there is always even also that it's usually infeasible to have complete test coverage in the sense that you actually produce all possible test sequences because there are just too many. So you need to select test cases for which you have sort of heuristics, but you don't know, in fact, in the critical case, whether your heuristics are actually sufficient. So this is, you cannot never really be sure about that. And this is why, of course, conformance testing is important, but in the setting of critical systems, it's useful to have a complementary approach which allows you to focus specifically on parts of the system or on aspects of the system, of the code now, on the code level, which may be especially vulnerable to weaknesses, such as buffer overflows, for example. And yeah, I cannot really explain how this works in detail, but I just mentioned that we've been doing some work in that direction. Yeah, and this I actually have to skip now because of the time. Very quickly mention, since I was asked about UML 2.0, here I just mentioned one of the new things because it's particularly relevant for what I've been saying in this tutorial. So one of the things that is now included in the mainstream UML is an extension which was previously included in the real-time version of UML. And this is about software architecture and in particular about three new concepts, namely capsules, ports, and connectors. I think I explained it best at the example. So this, in a way, is similar to what we had so far with deployment diagrams. Only it fits a bit better this situation here, in, for example, in embedded systems. The deployment diagram, we had nodes and components on the nodes, which are somehow connected by links and dependencies. This is these two different views are in these capsules sort of merged together to firstly having capsules and then being able again to link the capsules via connectors to other capsules. So in that sense, this is sort of more integrated form of deployment diagrams, if you like. And the point is just that what I said earlier about deployment diagrams, you can also now do with these new concepts in UML 2.0. And otherwise, I mean, the new UML version is backward compatible to the previous ones, so you can still use the diagrams used before. In particular, what I said today can still be used in UML 2.0, only there are some new concepts such as this one, which you can now also use in this context, and there are some changes in the way that the formal semantics is, the semantics of the UML is actually defined, but this is not really so interesting for the user of UML, but more for the researcher. And yeah, now just very quickly about tool support. As I said already, for this kind of approach, it's important to have some kind of tool support, because developers cannot expect it to analyze the UML diagrams together with the formal semantics manually. And the point is, the very point is that they should not be forced to do that. And firstly, as I mentioned already, one needs to define then a formal semantics to be able to construct tool support for verifying these different requirements, which I explained. And secondly, one would like to provide tool support. And yeah, the idea which we've been pursuing here is we wanted to use an industrially available drawing tool to keep the sort of the effort for people from industry as low as possible to take up this approach. And then, fortunately, there is actually a standard way of exchanging UML diagrams between tools, and this is the XMI format, which is a special XML dialect, and which you can use to exchange information about UML diagrams between tools. And then, how to do this exactly? You have different options. and how to process the XMI files. So firstly, of course, many general purpose languages now have integrated XML parsers, which you can in particular also use for XMI. Secondly, there are of course also many special purpose XML parsing languages, which you can also use in the setting. And thirdly, in XML and also in XMI, you have the concept of data binding, which allows you to access the information given in a XMI diagram or XMI file through Java methods. So you don't have to parse XMI or XML yourself, but you just access it through the methods. And this is actually what we've been doing in our work. Because, well, I mean, there's this framework which is specific for XMI. So firstly, you don't have to parse XML, and secondly, you don't have to worry about specific definitions of XMI, but you can access all of that through Java methods. And yeah, this I cannot really explain in detail now. Anyway, yeah, let's leave that out for time. The point is that we have now constructed a framework which allows you to implement different kind of checkers corresponding to the different kind of stereotypes which I explained earlier in a sort of uniform way. This is the wiki tool. okay, this is the architecture of the tool, how it's being developed at the moment. So the idea is that a developer uses a UML editor to create a UML model and to store it as XMI. And then using MDR, one can access the model through the Java methods. And our tool then firstly analyzes the model for static properties, and secondly for dynamic properties. So this corresponds to the different kind of stereotypes, where in the dynamic case, because the check is more resource intensive, you need specific kind of tool support, such as model checkers. And this is what we are currently working on, how to connect this in the setting of UMLSec properties, how to connect this to our tool. The static checker actually exists already, and also a part of the tool which extracts an execution trace from an activity diagram. And the goal is then, or the, what's happening then is that the developer gets back a text report about the possible problems with the UML design, and secondly, also a UML model where the particular points or the stereotypes which are actually violated are highlighted in the diagram. Yeah, so this is what is being developed at the moment. And you can actually, well, now the web interface actually works, so I think since last week or something. And you can access it through this website, so there you can now actually upload your UML model, provided they were written in this case, this UML tool Poseidon, which is actually freely available. And then, you can click on a button and the tool will automatically check these, or at least some of the stereotypes which I explained today. So this is not completely done yet, but some of them already work. And you also get, again, a UML model where the stereotypes are highlighted where there's a problem. And also what we're working on at the moment is, apart from just connecting it to this one model checker SMB, something else we have at the Lehrstuhl Breu has been developed for a couple of years now. This is the case tool autofocus, which is actually, or whose notation is actually similar to UML, although not quite the same. And this can actually do quite a few things in terms of simulation, validation, code generation, and so on. And this, but again, as I said, this is not exactly UML. And what we're working on at the moment also is to connect an actual UML tool to this analysis engine. Okay, now, so for the end of the presentation, just to point out some resources. So the book was mentioned already. This is, now the expected publication date is March 2004, if everything goes well. And there are some other tutorials on related topics planned on at some other conferences. And next week, actually, there's a workshop associated with the UML conference in San Francisco. And you can get the information on that on the website. And yeah, okay, and this is, well, if there were any industrial people in the audience, then this would have been the slide for them to ask for any challenges, but I think we're not today anyway. Okay, so I think we're now actually at the point where this meeting was supposed to start, so I think this is a good timing. So in principle, I could have given a demo, but now, of course, you can also see that on the internet, and it takes a bit of time to fire everything up, because I would need to start a web server on the laptop and so on, which would need a bit of time. So I think I leave this out now, and I point you to the web interface, and of course, if you have any questions now at this point. Okay, I guess we have had
How long will it take to start the demo?
I could of course do it outside, offline, for whoever is interested.
Well, no one here is going to the meeting.
Well, I think the meeting is here.
We meet the meeting room.
The meeting is here. Okay. who's interested, I can do that outside at the coffee tables or something.
Sure, internet
is
outside,
Yeah, okay, even that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You can do it in the registration room, just taking mm-hmm.
yes.
chairs and sitting
yeah.
around.
That would be fine.
Mm-hmm. Registration.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then thank you very much for your interest and for your attention, and that's so much for the tutorial. And thank you again for the opportunity to give this tutorial here. Thanks.